Hello, and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. We are your hosts,
Dwayne D.
and Drew Sarcini, and our third host, Tosin Anapwakan, couldn't join us today. We just watched the fourth episode of Starz American Gods, second season, titled The Greatest Story Ever Told. We assume you have as well. Total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the after talk, but first, let's catch you up on how you can reach us. Our online links, if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so at Gods Podcast or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. You can write us or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. And if you do so, add us on iTunes. And if you do that, please like us, leave us a review. That's how we get noticed. All right. Before we jump into the meat of our critical deconstruction analysis of The Greatest Story Ever Told, Dwayne, why don't you give us a recap of what we saw?
Right. Just to get us on the same page, we start off by meeting a boy who would become the CEO. As a child, he obeyed his father's wishes that he play the piano, but his passions always brought him back to technology, video games in the 80s to college in the late 90s, coding. Even taking the technology skills to music, he creates a Bach engine, artificial intelligence, that makes more Bach, even though Bach's been long gone. His father found the music interesting, but was disappointed with the method because it showed that his son didn't appreciate Bach, the art, in the way that he did. At his father's funeral, a quartet plays Bach as his son listens and visualizes a being playing techno Bach at the organ in the church. A technical boy seems to appear as if from nowhere. It's almost as if he's born. Meanwhile, Shadow is asleep during a storm at Jackal and Ibis's place in Cairo. He wakes up to find a woman eagerly awaiting intimate relations. She magically licks the wounds he sustained from torture and the train crash. I'm going to start that over again. Sorry, Andy.
No worries.
All right, 3, 2, 1. Meanwhile, Shadow's asleep during a storm at Ibis and Jackal's place in Cairo. He wakes to find a woman eager for intimate relations. She magically licks the wounds he sustained from torture and the train crash, healed before engaging intercourse. But she scratches him during the act. When Shadow wakes up, she's nowhere to be found, as if it were an erotic dream. The house cat's staring at him, and he looks in the mirror to find that the scratches are, in fact, real. Shadow leaves his room to find Mr. Ibis at work on a body in his funeral parlor. Ibis tells Shadow that death has changed Laura, and she's not the same person. Mm-hmm. Bilquis finds her way to the house of Jackal and Ibis and is confronted by Mr. Nancy. Bilquis states that Mr. World would have had her allegiance had he not killed Zariah. Bilquis, Nancy, and Ibis talk. Nancy gives a speech about human trafficking. The others are unmoved. They seek peace without war. We jump to Technical Boy and New Media sitting in what seems to be Mr. World's lair. It's the oversight place where Argus was. We learn that Media, in fact, died. That New Media is her reborn form. Mr. World then appears. He's bothered by Argus' death because he can't see the world as he used to. He attacks Technical Boy, who claims he has a friend who has a network that can use to gain back some of that Argus all-seeing functionality. Meanwhile, Shadow and Mr. Wednesday drive to St. Louis, Missouri, where they end up at a diner. Wednesday explains that money is a god because people worship it. Technical Boy finds the young man that we met earlier in the episode. He's now a powerful tech CEO. He suggests using the tech to track people, all people. He's surprised by Mr. World, who suddenly appears in the CEO's office and who's in the cahoots with the tech CEO. New Media takes the CEO's attention away, and Technical Boy is attacked by one of his own VR devices, which seems to gobble him up. Mr. World is then confronted by Girl Scouts from the diner in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. They grant him magical passage to where Shadow and Mr. Wednesday are. They seem to shift to the backstage, where there's a parlay about the war in front of Money. Money declines to take part in the war. And that is the episode. It's a little confusing, the sort of plot lines taken. But at the same time, I feel like they're really trying to build up to something. We're in the middle of the season. We know that this is an eight-episode season. So the ending of this episode is smack in the middle. And it seems like they're trying to build up to something before we hit the end. So it's a little surprising, but we're off to now, Andy.
So thank you for that recap. Now let's talk about the salient points about this episode here. First of all, the title, the greatest story ever told, which is, if you've seen this episode, it's a reference to money, which Wednesday mentions within the body of the show. He says, money, the greatest story ever told. A very cynical viewpoint, but I think that that fits it rather nicely. In general, my opinion about this episode, I felt like this was a meandering, pontificating, obtuse mess. I really had a hard time with this episode. It was a little disappointing for me.
Oh, really? What'd you like about it?
Okay, well, let me tell you what I did. what I did like about it was the opening 8 minutes. The opening 8 minutes with the CEO. The CEO's origin story, where he is just known as the son. You see this montage of the son and the father and their dynamics between each other, and you know his obsession with technology, and the father's sort of keeping him on the straight track about emotion and analog and feeling. I thought that was the most engaging sequence of the entire series so far. It almost felt like it was from a different, like I was watching it. I'm going, what
season two or both?
Both seasons. I'm like, I was watching this. I'm like, what show am I in? It didn't even feel like I was in the same show. And I was really caught up with it, engaged with it. And then we get to this moment at the end of this montage where the CEO, the son, is eulogizing his father, and we're assuming some sort of music that the son, this Bach generation, AI generated music, is playing over this, and that somehow conjures the embodiment of Technical Boy. And as soon as I saw Technical Boy materialize, my heart sank a little bit, because it was like, oh, we're going back into the bullshit again. That's right. We're done with this. Like, and so,
so I mean, let me just mention that's my feelings of that sequence. So, I mean, stylistically, it was very nice. It was a good departure. I kind of wish every episode opened up like that. I remember there was an episode with Mr. Nancy in like a slave ship, or the Middle Passage, right, where Africans were chained up.
Fantastic, and powerful monologue, right. a great showcase moment for Orlando
Jones.
It
was a set piece, and the monologue was backed up by the visuals surrounding him, right? And then the idea that, like, hey, let's just burn it all to the ground, which kind of establishes Nancy's militance. Here, what I really liked was you don't have a lot of time. Like, it's 8 minutes long. You don't have a lot of time. And what they do is establish a foundation of a young person who is obviously obsessed with, like, the video games, vices like video games, but then is still obedient when his father's like, it's piano time. Yeah. And he goes and does the piano time, and then he runs back to the video games. But all throughout it, there's a skill set he's using, right? So the character has these incredible hands and fingers that are just fantastic at basically taking his thought and putting it in his fingers. So whether he's thinking about video games, he's playing Pong, it's almost like his fingers are doing all the work, right?
Yeah, muscle memory, almost.
Huh?
Muscle memory, almost.
Exactly. He's got an incredible muscle dynamism. So he gets in front of the piano, he starts banging away at the keys, and he does it exactly as his father wants it. And what's really funny is, you would think that, and I mean, we've all seen how little kids do this, you ask them to do something and they rush through it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But here, the metronome is working. You can't rush through it when you're on time. Mm-hmm. So he has to play it exactly as it's meant to be played with the metronome going. And that's what I thought was very clever about it. They were like, okay, obviously this kid, any kid would rush through it, but this kid's different. So he pushes it through. He does it exactly as it should be. Then he goes back to video games. Then later on, and obviously his father's talking about the magic of Bach and how much he loves Bach and the backstory behind Bach and the whole idea of, like, sadness and solemnity plus this kind of like happiness that also is there's still hope, right? And so then you see him at school typing on his keyboard, and I think the way the camera work did the Pong, the piano, the keyboard, it really just tied it all in for me. I really enjoyed watching that, right? And I kind of felt it too. You know, like sometimes you're hearing a song and you feel like you can sing, like you feel the way the person is that's singing the song is singing it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like you're gonna get into it. I felt the way he was typing on that keyboard felt a lot like the way I feel like when I'm typing. It gave me the feeling like when I'm typing and I've got like an idea to get out and I've got to type fast, I've got to get it out really quickly. That's that feeling I got. So I really like gelled with that. I also love the fact that he built this artificial intelligence piece that could generate Nubok. And when his father was so excited that, hey, you're doing it just like Bach, right? And you could assume things. You can assume maybe the mom wasn't around, right? So there was sadness in their lives, whatever. Her father seemed to only get solace from Bach and his son. And then he's like, well, I used the computer to do it. And while he's explaining, you know, especially for the late 90s or late 80s, I couldn't quite tell what time it was. This is incredible technology to build.
Sure.
And his father doesn't, as much as it's clear that he doesn't appreciate his father's love of the art.
Right.
His father doesn't appreciate his son's incredible genius.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so clearly he's disappointed. And you could almost read the expression his father gives is, you just don't get it.
That expression is even like kind of like visible on that portrait in his funeral. Right. But I thought it was great that there was, if you paid attention enough, there was a kind of symbiosis. His father doesn't understand his son's incredible ability to do what he does in technology, and the son doesn't understand his father's incredible ability to appreciate the nuance of this art, right? Mm-hmm. And so that to me was fantastic. I love that whole single parent thing. I really got into it. But I also thought it was an interesting way to introduce Technical Boy. I kind of felt like I was watching Lost, because in Lost, whenever I saw like effectively like a cold open with a character, I felt like that character was going to die by the end of the episode.
Well, see, and to that end, it feels like this buildup of the backstory of who this character is was disproportionate to when we finally meet him, the impact of when we finally meet him. And unless that character turns out to be a major player from the rest of the series on, it feels like a lot of, I want to talk about my general feeling about this series so far is that, it seems like the series is more fascinated with style rather than plot. They frequently engage in what I consider this narrative masturbation, you know, basically showing off these great sequences of showing off some sort of backstory or some sort of, you know, these long takes that really lead to nothing in the overall plot. They're just sort of sidetracks.
Now that you say that out loud, I'm thinking there's this guy on YouTube called The Nerd Writer, and he's got a great video on Zack Snyder and the film Batman versus Superman. Mm. It's got a longer title than that.
Sure.
But in it, he talks about Snyder's obsession with moments rather than scenes and how a movie is actually built of several scenes.
Yeah.
But Snyder's so focused on moments that you end up with these spaces that are stylistically incredible.
Yes.
Like when the pearls get broken off of, you know, Martha Wayne's necklace as she gets shot.
Sure.
Or when Bruce Wayne falls down a hole and the bats come around him. And these moments are great to look at, but they don't actually help the story move along in a meaningful, fluidic way.
Right.
And I do think that while obviously, the sequence, the 8-minute sequence, was a beautiful series of scenes.
Yeah.
It may not have been necessary. And American Gods does, like you say, likes to stylistically create these moments. But are they actually tied together in a way that seems fluid? Are they edited together in a way that helps us understand the story better? And in this episode, for sure, I've got to say I was confused over half the episode, so I don't know if Brawl's Beauty, if it was worth it.
I don't mean to come down on the show, but I do feel like when you're subscribing to this podcast and you're listening to us, what you want is a critical examination of the series. So
sure,
we have to give it to you warts and all, so that's my take on it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, the reason we started the podcast is because we really enjoyed the American Gods book. We were excited about the adaptation. It looks like they want to do different things, expand on it. and they have in many ways, and they're things that we have liked, but there's definitely some frustration to be had with the way that they run things a little bit here. But yeah, let's move on to some more salient points.
Yeah. So, Dwayne, did you want to talk about the Ibis and his
Oh yeah, he was discussing the whole his identity basically. So it was interesting to me that the Shadow comes in after his whole like frolic with Cat Lady, and he's like, "What do you guys do here?" As Ibis basically is cutting through someone's body, and he's like, "Well, we've been here since 18 whatever, since before the Civil War. You know, back then we were just people.
Right.
You know, we came here from Egypt, and then we became colored, and now we're African American." And it was interesting. I think unfortunately it felt a little flat, but I think in the book what he kind of lays out is the fact that so many people aren't native to America.
Sure.
That you know, many of them are just Americans. But if you're a person of African descent who's been in America, whose family's been in America for a very long time, there's a lot of identity change that's happened, right? There's been, you know, obviously there were bad words that they were called, and then you know, they go to being colored people. Throughout all the time, they've been called black people. But then there's the term Negro, which was a preferred term for quite some time. That moved into Afro-American, which is now African-American. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like a continually change of the way you refer to the same people. And I think if you're Neil Gaiman, who's a guy coming from Britain, that's pretty fascinating to see people who've been in the country since before the country was the country constantly get new names. I think that's what Ibis is going for.
I agree that's a really interesting point, but I feel like that maybe that point was only sort of glanced upon and not really like I would
have. It wasn't dealt with. There could have been a nice scene where you might have seen a montage of Ibis and Jaquel through the years, right? Mm-hmm. Like when they were working back, if they were really there back in 1820 or whatever, and as things changed around them, you know, the Civil War happens, whatever. That would have been interesting because then you would have been able to see the context of those different names and what they meant.
Sure.
Right?
And provided it was organically folded into the narrative.
Right. Exactly. And I think that there was, you know, there's 8 minutes they could have used to do that in. So that was interesting. Andy, you want to talk about Bilquis when she saw that mourner?
Yeah. So she comes into Ibis Jaquel's parlor and she confronts a mourner in the funeral parlor. Who is she has a name and it's Ruby Goodchild.
Yeah, Ruby.
Yes, sorry, I was finding it. But there and Ruby Goodchild is mourning her grandmother. So she seems to acknowledge that Bilquis seems to acknowledge the beetle running atop an empty coffin when she walks toward it. Which could very well be like a reference to the Egyptian origins of Ibis and Jaquel.
Yeah, that was interesting because it's like, obviously it's like CGI or whatever, but she just glances at it for a moment. And what's also interesting is that we know that coffin's empty because Ibis is working on her grandmother right there.
Right, right. Bilquis mentions that it's empty. And Ruby mentions that they're working on her.
Exactly. I thought that the whole Ruby thing, I mean, I don't know how necessary Ruby was, but it seemed like she was a cipher for Bilquis to sort of like get out some knowledge that she had, right? She later talks about she's challenging mainstream ideas of gods by linking the pastor's words that Ruby tells her, right, to a raising the sun, right? So basically, Ruby is like, the pastor thinks that God's just an idea. And Bilquis is like, your pastor's copying from A Raisin in the Sun, which is a late 1950s, early 1960s play by Lorraine Hansberry that is considered a touchstone, a watershed moment in playwriting in the 20th century, right? So just to kind of go into what that means in terms of context, here's a quote from A Raisin in the Sun. Quote, "Then Mama and Ruth are discussing with her what she really wants to do in the future, Ruth says. Of course you're going to be a doctor, honey, God willing. And Benitha is a young woman who's the daughter of Mama. Benitha instantly replies by saying, God hasn't got a thing to do with it. She further explains that this radical claim made by her in the household when she says, I'm just tired of hearing about God all the time. What does he got to do with anything? Does he pay tuition? It's all a matter of ideas, and God's just one idea I don't accept. It's not important. I'm not going to go out and be immoral or commit crimes because I don't believe in God. I don't even think about it. It's just that I get tired of him getting credit for all the things the human race achieves through its own stubborn effort. There simply is no blasted God. There's only a man, and it's he who makes miracles, right? So this is effectively where the pastor that Ruby was talking to, that's where the pastor that Ruby was talking to gets the idea that God's only an idea.
Sure.
And I thought it was one of those things where clearly Neil Gaiman, being Neil Gaiman, has read A Race in the Sun as a seminal work in sort of the American canon. And it's also interesting because Bilkis as a god is basically saying that God is just an idea. It's also interesting because we're talking about American gods. We talk about all these kind of ancient gods, and it's pretty clear that the one god we don't see is sort of the Abrahamic god of the Muslims and the Jews and the Christians.
Sure.
And by mentioning God in this way, just an idea, not really there, it kind of sort of answers the question of how come we haven't seen the big guy, right? And then later on in the episode, we realize that Mr. Wednesday thinks the big guy is effectively money, right? So there's no actual place for God, capital G-O-D, as many people around the world see him, in the universe that American Gods takes place in, which to me is very interesting.
Well, you know, it's interesting also that the idea that God is not just in our imagination, but only has a significance that we as humans place upon it. I think that concept can be tied to the discussion of money later on, where we're talking about paper money having only the significance that we attach to it.
Right. I think that's a really good point. As Bilquis says this, Mr. Nancy interrupts her, saying, a woman's heart should be so hidden in God that a man has to seek him just to find her. And Bilquis then says, huh? And he's like, I'm going to attribute that to Maya Angelou. And I remember hearing that and thinking, that's not a thing that Maya Angelou would say. Right? So I looked it up.
His quote,
a woman's heart should be so hidden in God that a man has to seek him just to find her. And in fact, there are a lot of people who do believe that Maya Angelou said that. But a search across the internet shows conflicting reports. Max Lucado, who's a best-selling religious author, is also attributed with that quote. So most people believe it was Lucado, right? And he basically has these ideas about God that are taken in by certain evangelical sectors of the Christian population. But another poet named Carol Wimmer claims that she wrote the line. So my first inclination is to think the writers got it wrong, that they were just kind of hopping around on Google, saw, hey, Maya Angelou said this, let's just put this in there. But then again, this is Mr. Nancy, who's a Nancy, a trickster, right?
Right.
So using a quote and placing it with Maya Angelou to get the effect of like, well, Maya Angelou said it, you better respect it.
Interesting. Interesting.
It's the kind of thing he'd do if he thinks he could make a point, win an argument, even if it's not true. So even though I think my head canon says this was a mistake, I'm rewriting that canon to say that Mr. Nancy's trying to trick them.
That is an interesting reading of that scene. That's something I need to consider. Yeah, because he is a trickster.
So I mean, Orlando Jones was just kind of going with the flow, but we'll talk about Orlando Jones later. Andy.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Technical Boy and his need to replace the network.
So yeah, so when Technical Boy goes to the CEO's company, GCOM, which seems to be some sort of telecommunications conglomerate. We're not entirely sure. It's not explicit.
Huawei-ish, kind of?
Yeah, or? We think so. So at Shecom, it seems to me that what he's proposing the CEO do is use his client's products, which we're assuming is some sort of telecommunication devices like cell phones, to surveil the connected population as a replacement for Argus Panoptes, who was killed in last week's episode. And I just wanted to point out that very same strategy was the one employed by Lucius Fox in the
Dark Knight.
In the Dark Knight, yeah.
Christopher Nolan's depiction of the Dark Knight, right, starring Christian Bale and Morgan Freeman as Lucius Fox.
It's Morgan Freeman's character, yeah, proposes to Christian Bale, to Bruce Wayne, he actually does it. He actually programs all the cell phones, Wayne Enterprise cell phones, to surveil, that create this neural net of surveillance,
so that they can find the Joker or something.
Exactly.
Right. Which is, you know, by the way, it's the Batman Bruce Wayne character that wants it done, and Lucius Fox has ethical issues with it.
Right.
So because of that, he basically quits he resigns after the deed has been done, because of ethical terribleness that is spying on people with their devices. Whereas Technical Boy, when he's talking about it, is basically like, these people want us to spy on them.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to be smooth about it. He's like,
he's trying to be Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, that could be it. So he's trying to, he's like, these people want us to look into what they're doing. They've opted in for all, he all but says they've opted in for all of this. And as he does so, the CEO, like, his face is kind of wincing, but at the same time, now we know it's because he doesn't care what he says. He's already made a deal with Mr. World. It's all very interesting.
Dwayne, you before we close out this section, you wanted to mention something about last week's episode that we had overlooked.
Right. So last week, Munin, right? That was the episode, and the word Munin is, you know, one of Odin's crows.
Right.
So Odin has two crows. Odin is Mr. Wednesday, and we see one of the crows kind of hang out on the windowsill of Jackal and Ibis's place in Cairo. It's cawking. What crows do, they cawk or crack or whatever the word is for their sound. And, you know, Mr. Wednesday is like, okay, I get it. I see what's going on. We're good. Right? And then the crow leaves. You later see a crow taking out one of Argus's, like, drones. But later in the episode, we meet Sam Black Crow.
Sure.
And since we know that the episode's named after one of his crows, we don't know which crow he's talking to. Now, we mentioned that Sam Black Crow was obviously a crow in an episode named for crows.
Sure.
But it occurred to us that perhaps Sam Black Crow is one of Wednesday's crows, because she does find Shadow serendipitously. She catches him in the act, so she recognizes the con that he's trying to pull on the gas station attendant in last episode. And, you know, Mr. Wednesday's a con man, Shadow's a con man. That is, she recognizes the con, but she doesn't pull him out for it. And maybe she's trained by Wednesday. And then she drops him off right at Ibis and Jaquel's place in Cairo. I don't know that Shadow knew he had to go right there, but she seems pretty comfortable being like, okay, see you around. So that's just the thing, that Sam Black Crow may indeed be one of Wednesday's crows.
Yeah, it's unclear. I mean, I think do we come back? Will we come back to her again? Or was this just another of American Gods' notorious side trips that lead? Yeah.
I mean, I hope so, because when you do read the books, there's a place for her that is more meaningful. So that's pretty key. And I do think that an announcement that she'd be on the show, as we saw in some of the media stuff before the season aired, indicates that she might be more than just a kind of a one-off in one episode. But I do think that, I hope we see more. I think the performance was pretty strong. And I think, you know, the chemistry between her and Mickey Whittle made Mickey Whittle act a little better. So there you go.
Yeah. Before we get into our big picture, let's talk about some unanswered questions. Dwayne, did you have some questions about this episode that you didn't seem to know what was going on?
Yes, I have three questions. The first one was, what was with the Girl Scouts, right?
Mm-hmm. I have a theory, but go ahead and you tell me what your theory is.
So at first I thought they were the three fates, right? Like, you know, the three fates, that's a thing in like God lore, sure. Right? They're in the Norse mythology, they're in Greek mythology. But there wasn't enough there to really hone that in, right? So, but you had an idea who they could be, right?
Yeah. So my theory is that it's very simple. They're like a credit check, ID verification. You know, they.
Then what's the third one? Huey, Dewey, and Louie. Like, what's.
Well, no, I mean, I don't think each of them. I think all three of them as a group represent this credit check. And essentially, before money, because money is traded via credit or debit.
It's loaned out. You need to see who you're giving it to.
Right. You need some sort of collateral or some sort of trust of verification. And I think that's what these girls.
Otherwise, you get subprime mortgage crisis.
Right. That's what these Girl Scouts represent, and that's why they when they ask Wednesday what he wants, and he says gold bars, nuggets, and they ask credit or debit. He says what he chooses one, and he says, I'm good for it, basically. You know who I am. I'm good for it. Check my credit. And they go right to check Shadow Moon, and Shadow Moon is a cipher. Like he doesn't exist. He has never applied for a credit card. He's never borrowed on credit. So that basically, you know, you have to in real life, you have to establish a credit history before you can use credit, because
which becomes like a never ending cycle of a company being able to surveil you and judge you,
right?
And
right.
Kind of capriciously put a number on you. And it's interesting that Shadow, I mean, his name is Shadow, right? He's hard to perceive.
Yes,
other gods have been like, I can't figure you out.
But this is again typical American gods. They're always using a $10 metaphor when a $2 literalism will suffice. So
I'm a little envious that Shadow doesn't have any. He's off the grid on the credit score side. It'd be nice if my credit score is fine, but I think in this world of complete online everything,
yeah,
it'd be nice if no one could find you unless you wanted them to find you, you know?
Yeah. And I think that maybe that sort of defines Shadow's character, and it'll probably come into play more often through the rest of the series. Another question you had, Dwayne?
Right. The CEO, the son, did he create Technical Boy? Or was he simply the first follower, first worshiper? Technical Boy says, yeah, this is my first worshiper. But we see the Technical Boy as sort of like, he becomes manifest during the dad's funeral, kind of when the last, so in that boy's life, and in the son and the CEO's life, he's all technology except for his dad's like art.
Yeah.
And then when his dad finally dies, that's when the art dies, right? That's when he no longer has art. He can become all about technology. He doesn't get bothered.
I don't know. It's a little frustrating and a little inconsistent, because I can understand. I don't think, first of all, I don't think that the CEO, the son, created Technical Boy. By the same token, I can't imagine that, you know, this is, we're talking about I'm trying to place the era, maybe about the 90s, I would say. We're talking about the 90s. I can't imagine that in the 90s, this son, the CEO, this future CEO, could have possibly been the first person to worship technology. It seems rather inconsistent and incongruent.
I mean, so when we think about technology today, you know, I'm thinking like, you've got this modern incarnation of technology run by a lot of these Gen Xers, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, sort of like this modern incarnation of technology, as Technical Boy, maybe that works. Then again, Technical Boy said he mentioned like the abacus and all these other things back in the day.
Yeah.
That's also worth mentioning because we know that like gods live inside of other gods, kind of. Mm-hmm. So it was just confusing. It's not clear to me whether
he
made it, but that leads to the last question I have, which is Technical Boy dead?
That is a good question. That's a very good question. All we can gather from literally the textual information that we have is Mr. World says, "I just retired a god, or I retired a god today." He says that to the Girl Scouts, and that's sort of like the credentials that get him into meeting with money.
That's one way to look at that. I didn't really put that together. Again, I was a little frustrated trying to follow how this episode moved forward.
So what we know literally is he retired him, but we don't know what retired means. If that means he
took him out, or if he just kind of like locked him,
put
in
him away,
jail
put
cell.
Him on a shelf temporarily, or got rid of him forever. So
right, which is interesting. It's also interesting language considering the actor.
Yeah.
That plays Money. What was his name again?
William Sanderson.
William Sanderson. Yeah. He was prominent in Blade Runner as one of the technical people, the technical boy, literally, mm-hmm. under Mr. Tyrell in 1986
sure,
Blade Runner.
Sure.
And in that film, they use the term retiring
sure.
liberally. They even established in the very beginning in text that this wasn't called killing, it was called retirement.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, while I don't know if there's a direct correlation between the two, it does strike me as a little funny, that they'd use the word retire when he's about to stand in front of a guy who is in a movie that's famous for having retired technical beings. So
yeah, I mean, I would say that's it's a bit of a stretch. But, you know, it's something. It's definitely something.
A little inside joke from Gaiman to the rest of us.
I think that as far as retiring, or you know, there is a little bit of thread to this, because earlier on in the episode, Mr. World says that when Technical Boy is making his case to the CEO, Mr. World says, "I've never seen a god more effectively argue his obsolescence." So even Mr. World realizes that Technical Boy and New Media are overlapping. They're a little bit redundant,
especially since Argus, on whatever level he merged with Media, he wasn't finished merging with her when he got killed or whatever. But Argus was a lot of technology. And New Media apparently took him in. Who knows what it meant, right? Is she impregnated? Who knows? Whatever. But at the end of the day, that was definitely a scene. But again, that kind of felt like one of those moments, as opposed to like a scene with real like fluidity to the next moment. So
right.
So there's that. But that seems to bring us over to the big part, huh?
Yeah. So let's talk about our big picture section, which is the now that we're done with the salient points of the episode, this is the section where we discuss how the events in this particular episode impact what we know about the overarching story arc. So, Dwayne, you want to lead us off?
We learned that Anansi, Bilquis, they're of an age, right? They're pretty much the same age. It kind of comes out during the discussion with Ibis. We also know that Ibis is much older. As they talk, the three of them, these quote-unquote African gods, I say that quote-unquote because they're American gods. They just happen to have shown up from Africa. there's this triangle here. Nancy wants war, right? Bilquis doesn't seem to know what she wants. She didn't want to work for World, but she's not going to fight for the old gods either. And Ibis is pretty clear. He says, I think we can solve this peacefully, amicably. And that's in part because Ibis has been around in America for, at this point, hundreds of years, as has Nancy. Ibis is like, I've been through it all. I don't need to go through any kind of war. And he kind of does. I mean, it's his place, so he's got a certain amount of seniority. But he also seems to come across as the one who kind of is fatherly to the two of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Bilquist and Nancy kind of make out for a moment, which is a strange moment. And Mr. Ibis is like, "You kids," you know, like it's that whole thing was like a little weird.
I did find it
a little weird. You wanted to talk about how strange that whole situation was, right?
Yeah. Well, I did like the idea of Anansi, Bilquis, and Ibis forming this triumvirate of people of color who, and Anansi, there's this moment where he does pontificate about the fact that in this situation, we have three African gods who are essentially impotent in this upcoming war, that they need to step up and do something about their situations. But I feel like that Mr. Anansi, he spends the show in general spends an inordinate amount of time pontificating and speechifying, and often on the same theme over and over again, which is the oppression of the immigrant in the New World by forces of power, which is, I mean, that's kind of this one of the central themes of the show, and it's fine for them to focus on that, but the show tends to subscribe to the tell don't show philosophy of storytelling rather than show don't tell, which is
hard in TV, right? Like, it's one thing if you got to tell a story in a book, right? Like,
yeah.
One character says, "Hey, this is what happened to John."
Yeah.
Right. It's another thing if you're like kind of doing that over and over in a medium designed to be completely and utterly visual.
Exactly. It's just, which comes across to me as just lazy writing.
Even radio.
I would really love to see them make a lot more of these points visually rather than in monologues, which is what I feel like we're seeing over and over again, these monologues, which are great. They make for great scenes, but then it overall feels a little didactic and preachy.
Yeah, so I mean, and you know me, I don't like to go into like the sort of behind the scenes, yeah, Hollywood, whatever, but it's pretty clear that this may have been one of the issues that led to Fuller and Green leaving, because when you have lower budgets, which seems to be the case with American Gods season 2, they only have 80 episodes. A lot of shows have 10, 13 episodes these days, high quality TV like this. And so in that 8 episodes, they don't have the time to show everything they need to show. So they're going to have to speed it up by having one character expound to another character. Hey, this is what this person, whatever. Here's a story here. You get that download and it's fine because it'll help move the story along. But it also falls flat when it comes to sort of entertaining you with, you know, the power of TV, of cinema. And in this world today, TV is all but little cinema. So it is heavy. It can get tiring. And I think what really happens is you phase out. Like, it doesn't matter anymore. He could be talking about the most important thing.
Right.
But you stop paying attention because you're like, oh, Mr. Nancy's at it again. Right. You're just kind of close to it.
Yeah. And I think we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into the performances of the show. But yeah, I feel like they could catch more flies as far as the points that they're trying to express on the show with the honey of showing them visually rather than the vinegar of pontificating on them. Dwayne, you want to talk about media?
Yeah, so we learned that media didn't just change, right? Clearly she went through a metamorphosis. But from what we understand, the media that we knew died, right? New media is a reborn form. And she says something to the effect of she can feel the old media inside of her, right? She's not the same entity that's got a new shell. She's a new entity. She just seems to have the memories of the old entity. And this kind of makes sense because they kind of established with Argus that Argus kept on dying and he kept on coming back. And even when Laura is about to kill Argus, Wednesday says, or after she's killed Argus, Wednesday says, now that you've killed him, when he comes back, he'll know what team he needs to be on, right? So the gods do die, and they do come back when they have worshippers. Zariah, on the other hand, when she was shot and she ended up dead, she doesn't have any followers, and that's why Chernabog was so upset. Mm-hmm. There's no worshippers left, so there's no way for her to come back. That was the last incarnation of her. The incarnation of New Media that we see is different because the media landscape has changed so much that she is what we think of when we look at media. You know, slightly glamorous. When you look at the media landscape, I mean, what was it? PewDiePie was upset that the YouTube channel was going to get surpassed by an Asian YouTube channel out of India, right? It's more representative. It's more about like Instagram and Facebook and social media. So old media is gone, is wiped out, and new media is left inside of her, which makes us wonder what's going to happen with Technical Boy, right? He gets destroyed or he gets retired. We think he might be dead. And is there going to be a new incarnation of him, or is he just no longer, is he obsolete, as Mr. World said? But at the end of the day, we know that even if God's Reborn, the previous one is dead, it's not the same entity. The new entity represents the same thing, or the modified version of the same thing. And it kind of reminds me of the Avatar cycle in Avatar: The Last Airbender, the one super important animation show Andy's never seen.
Yet.
Andy, who works in animation.
But I still haven't seen Cowboy Bebop, too, by the way.
That's true. Cowboy Bebop's only 26 episodes. I think Avatar is like 30. But at the end of the day, in the Avatar cycle, if the Avatar dies after 49 days, a new person is born who will become the Avatar, kind of like the Dalai Lama in Tibet, right? The new Avatar is a new and wholly different person, but he's got or she's got the memories and the understanding of the people before her. And so it's a little bit like Jadzia Dax, I guess. So those are two popular references that kind of seem to explain what's going on with these gods morphing from one body to another or dying and coming back.
Yeah, and I have to say that I feel like I don't know whether this this change in the arc of media was instigated
planned or was because
was
she left.
It was planned or because Gillian Anderson left the show, but I think it's one of the most savvy changes and
nice way to roll.
Yeah. It's one of the smartest things that the show has done is the basically reflecting on what the nature of media is, what it used to be
in
and what it is now.
2019, yeah.
Yeah, so.
Because the book came out in like 2001.
Props to them, whether it was serendipity or what, for taking the situation and rolling with it in an intriguing way.
I'll speculate, and I'll say that had Gillian Anderson stayed, because of the kind of incredible morphing that we saw her do in season one, from Lucy to David Bowie to Liza Minnelli's mother, Julie Garland, I could see her embodying some type of new media had the actual actress stayed, right? They would have done something
to make her
relevant. They would have turned her into a Kardashian or something, right? But if you have to deal without her, this is a fantastic way to do it. And
agreed.
If they have gotten rid of Technical Boy, that's fine too, because that just gives us a little bit more time with new media, who I think is something that we can all understand a bit better, right? Than sort of an avatar of all technology, which kind of seems a little too broad, that kind of thing. So,
yeah,
that was interesting.
Another point you'd like to make, Dwayne, about Bilquis?
Right. So, big picture, Bilquis says to Ruby Goodchild, wow, what a name, right?
Yeah.
quote, they say he died for your sins, but that's not the truth. He died because he angered the men in power. He refused to be cowed, controlled. And now look at the power he wields, the worship he commands. He was onto something, unquote.
So this is referring to Jesus.
Right. So she's referring to Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Now, Jesus is not necessarily a god, but in American God's world, he would be, because people worship him, right? In Christianity, he's the Son of God. He's part of God, if you believe in the Trinitarian tradition of Christianity as opposed to the Unitarian tradition of Christianity. But all that aside, basically, it's another way of them kind of not really dealing with the whole fact that we live in a world where a lot of people believe in this one God. But what's really interesting, seems kind of contradictory or possibly hypocritical, is that this seems in contrast to the depictions of Jesus that we saw in the season finale about five episodes ago.
Right.
So the,
where
the
he was trying to cross
one,
the border, right, as an immigrant, and he gets shot by
Border Patrol Corbin Burnson.
Right.
Right. So they're all topical back then. So we see Jesus like trying to make it across the border, and he ends up dead. Then we get to Easter's house, and there's like 95 Jesuses, right?
Right.
What?
Right, that's right. The different Jesuses. I forgot about that.
Right, so there's the baby Jesus on Mary's breast. There's, kind of a hippie Jesus. There's just a lot of different Jesuses. And rather than being coalesced into one powerful figure the way money is, right?
Yeah.
Or a technical boy was, or whatever, or new media is. It's fragmented. And I guess, obviously, in America, Christian traditions are fragmented. But Bilquis seems to suggest that Jesus is super powerful because he was onto something. But when we see Jesus in American Gods, there's a whole bunch of Jesus, which actually felt right. It felt right to make a whole bunch of different Jesuses. But it doesn't seem like he was onto something if he wasn't able to consolidate that power in the way we've seen matter to all the gods in American Gods.
Yeah. I agree. I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know what these references mean or how they're connected, or even if they're keeping track of what they say about one character like Jesus in one season or one episode in another compared to another episode. If they've been tracking all of this stuff, or if it even matters, who knows?
Right. I mean, on some level, it might have been, again, Ruby Goodchild seemed to be a cipher for Bilquis, giving us an opportunity to get to know Bilquis a little bit more without Bilquis sucking some man through her vagina, which was the only way we got to know her season one, right?
Right. And lastly, I want to talk about Mr. Wednesday and his, basically, the point that he makes about money, about currency. And I mentioned this, briefly touched upon this earlier, but he's talking about the when he shows the paper currency to Shadow, he says, "This paper is only worth something because you believe in it, you worship it. It's telling a story, you know." And it's a general sort of low hanging fruit point that he's making, but I think that the show does imagine it to be a little bit more profound by making that point. So
yeah, I mean, they have to, in order to make, I guess they're looking at us and they're saying, well, people worship stuff, they're worshiping technology, clearly people worship money, we have to get him off the board. Because it's kind of like, you know, you can't have Captain America and Civil War. If Thor were there, it wouldn't have been a fight, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If Thor had chosen one side or the other. So I feel like what they wanted to do was make sure that the plot hole watching audience wouldn't think, hey, where's money? And then ask that question. So they put money out there and then they pushed him off to the side.
Sure.
Before
Mr. World and Wednesday meet with Money, the accountant, you know, Mr. World does make a point to Wednesday to think about money. That he notes that the currency is no longer physical, but ones and zeros, but digital. So I'm not sure necessarily how all that ties in either. But I feel
that
like
kind of, I did think of something when you said that.
Yeah.
So it used to be, we used to think of the auto sector as a sector of the economy, right?
Yeah.
And it's become pretty clear with the rise of Tesla and like Volvo and all those other guys that auto isn't its own sector. Technology is a sector, and auto is part of technology.
Right.
So money is is a thing. Currency is a thing. But now it's being changed by technology, right? Whether it's the new Apple card or it's Bitcoin or whatever. So it's kind of like when you get rid of technical boards because everything is using technology. Technology itself isn't worshipped anymore like that because everything, for instance, your washing machine will be internet connected. Like all these things are just going to have technology. It's kind of like the word color TV, right? Yeah. We used to say color TV. Now we just say TV. You used to say HDTV. Now we just say TV. Now we say 4K TV. But in a few years, those will be the only TVs around. So it's like technology in and of itself is not a thing. It's just a piece of everything else.
Sure.
And so when he says it kind of backs up the idea that technical boy needs to go away.
Well, and it also seems like it's a veiled threat by Mr. World, basically establishing his dominance, saying that the new gods are going to subsume the old gods. So,
which is interesting because Mr. World was like, "We can't do anything without building on the old."
Right, right. So. Which is why, again, and I think that ties into the fact that they need to show some sort of fealty to money. You know, to this accountant as money. They need to appeal to him. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to wrap up our big picture section here. Let's go on to some performances. So once again, earlier in this episode, we talked about Orlando Jones and his the fantastic actor Orlando Jones. And he's doing a great job with this character, Anansi, and really injecting some fire into it. But I do have to say that, and this is not his fault, he's doing the best he can, but when, you know, we saw in that season one opener when we first meet Anansi, he delivers this fire and brimstone of a monologue that is really quite potent. And again, one of the most engaging and memorable scenes in the entire series. But now we've seen like two or three of them that Orlando Jones has been delivering. And that's the fault of the writers. But I feel like every time that we hear Anansi with this powerful, fiery monologue, it lessens the impact overall of the delivery of the whatever message that he's trying to send. It's like I feel like it just needs to be sort of fewer and far between and really impactful when it happens and not just a new episode with a new Anansi fiery monologue.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I think we're in a place where the show is missing an opportunity when it comes to Jones. He's good, and there's a lot of good, interesting ways to use him. When he was doing that monologue on the boat, at least it was backed up by the visuals, right? And he was talking to people, and people performed action after his speech to rally them,
right?
So it was integrated into the scene we were looking at. Likewise, there was this talk about African gods not doing things and whatever. There is a lot of African culture that has been completely integrated, like that scene was, into mainstream American culture, right? The way we say things, you know, whether it's slang or whatever, most of that comes, it's spawned up in throughout the African diaspora in America, and then it becomes kind of mainstream, right? You'll hear news anchors say words like chill, which are like, what? You know? Slow your roll, all that stuff. So there's a lot to show and use Jones in that links more deeply into sort of American culture. And instead, they're kind of just keep on like hammering this whole thing about injustice in a way that isn't appealing or entertaining. And again, you drone out or whatever, right? So it's a little bit weak, and I think they can make it stronger if they really wanted to think about it and approach it smartly.
I agree. All right. Do you want to talk about some ephemeral, some stuff that is sort of extra textual to the episode, but stuff that's mentioned about or things to reference, other places for people to explore about things connected to this episode?
Sure thing. I'll just run down the list really quickly. While this episode was a little bit confusing when it came to the plot, and I think it may have wasted some time here or there, it definitely gave us a ton of ephemera. First, we have the Book of Toth, right? That's mentioned when Shadow, when Orlando Jones's Nancy is talking to Ibis. It turns out the Book of Toth is a book that was mentioned in ancient Egyptian fiction. It's kind of like the Book of the Dead. It's one of those fancy books that helps people do stuff. It's one of the sources of the tarot that we use when you go to get a tarot reading.
So,
Raisin in the Sun is mentioned, right?
Mm-hmm.
That is a play by Lorraine Hansberry. It's a seminal work of 20th century playwriting, right? It's right mm-hmm. up there with To Kill a Salesman or
To Kill a Mockingbird.
Death of a Salesman. Right. To Kill a Mockingbird is a book that's been turned into a play.
Sure.
The Death of a Salesman. And it's a fantastic read if you have a moment. It's really good. Tragically, Hansberry, the writer, died at like age 35 or something
mm-hmm.
Of cancer. Maya Angelou was mentioned. She's a poet laureate. She's fantastic. Sure. She says a lot of really awesome, clever, surly things. And she's a completely wonderful example of the integration of African culture into the mainstream in America. And so that's worth checking out. Max Lucado, he's a Christian writer and philosopher. The quote that Nancy said that he falsely attributed to Maya Angelou may in fact be his. It's certainly a quote he used. Whether he used it first or not is a matter of debate. But you can check his stuff out. He's got really interesting notions on applying Christianity to the modern world and modern lifestyle. Carol Wimmer is also a poet. She claims the quote was hers. Mm-hmm. The man should find the woman behind God, so he has to look for God, that kind of thing. So you can check her out. We mentioned Avatar The Last Airbender. Andy, you should totally see that. But it's a great speculative world that's built around the ideas of spirits, not gods. But if you think that you're kind of into this sort of pantheon of stuff, it's worth seeing sort of an Asian-inspired American vision of high fantasy. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And then finally, I mentioned Trills like Jadzia Dax. That's from Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And if you like the idea of turning into someone else but staying the same, it's worth checking out that character.
You're talking about like shapeshifters?
No. So she is... her species is called a Trill.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm not that familiar.
Join Trills get a symbiote inside them.
Oh, got it.
When the person dies, like Jadzia did die.
Sure.
Ezri was joined to the Trill, but Ezri has the memories of Jadzia and Curzon and a whole bunch of other people going back 300 years.
Got it.
So even though she's like 25, she remembers what it was raising her kids. Mm-hmm, she remembers mm-hmm. what... Now, she's not those people. She's her own person. But she's got all of the memories, so in some way they're kind of alive.
That makes perfect sense. I remember that character. So I think that is going to do it for this episode of The Dominant Paradigm, our podcast about Star's American Gods. Join us next week on The Dominant Paradigm, where we talk about the next episode of American Gods titled The Ways of the Dead. Interesting. So it sounds like we'll probably be spending more time with Ibis and Jackal, I would imagine, right?
Yeah, maybe some backstage action.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's going to do it for us. Dwayne, where can people find your work when you're not here on The Dominant Paradigm?
Check me out on twitter.com/DwayneD, and check me out on geeksofdoom.com. Andy, what about you?
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com or do a Google search for Mr. Babyman, my social media handle, or Andrew Cersini. You'll find all the stuff that I'm linking and liking throughout the week there. And otherwise, that's it. Join us next week here on the Geeks of Doom Podcast Network for The Dominant Paradigm. We'll see you next week.